S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that only runs on premium unleaded. I'm Scott Phillips. With me, as always, is Dr. Anirvan Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Scott. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And your good self?
I'm very, very
excellent. I do call him Doc around the office, so hence the introduction. Doc, we got a few things to cover, and with the mention of premium unleaded, it wasn't just me going off on a tangent. We're going to talk about Woolies and Caltex and the fuel deal that was done this week. We're also going to talk about a couple of broker downgrades from a couple of formerly darling stocks, Bellamy's and Domino's. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about a bit of the consolidation and, frankly, a bit of the kind of pushing and shoving in the media and advertising space. Mm-hmm. And the credit crunch. Is it on or is it off?
Credit crunch.
A few different perspectives we're going to go through. And I know you like talking about property, Doc, but I will try and keep you to no more than a couple of hours worth of ranting, if that's okay with you.
I love property.
And you're going to get on your... Speaking of property, you are going to get in your high horse. You've promised me this week I won't be on property, though, right?
All right. I'll try to keep
I'll take your word for it. Mate, this week we had Woolies and Caltex finally agreeing to a deal on fuel. Now, the background here is that Caltex currently provide Woolies with the service stations at which they can redeem their 4-cent shopper dockets and their kind of rewards program. And Woolies had tried to dump Caltex. They tried to do a deal instead with BP. But the ACCC got a little bit involved, said, guys, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. No deal. Woolies and Caltex almost kind of forced into getting back together again. And it kind of feels like a reasonable deal for both of them. Despite this being plan B, Woolies gets a bit of extra profit, a whole lot of extra service stations, and Caltex gets to keep the fuel supply. What's going on?
Well, I mean, okay, so there's Woolies has been trying to sort of dump, actually, the fuel business for some time. It tried to sell it off to, I believe, BP. That got knocked back by ACCC. The ACCC then said, based on ACCC's restrictions, I guess what Woolies figured is, well, they got to go back to Caltech. And so it looks like a good deal for both of them. The Woolies CEO is on record to say that, you know, they are looking at options to exit that business.
Right.
So whether by an IPO or, you know, an asset sale or something like that.
In fact, as part of the deal they've announced, or maybe not as part of the deal, but at the same time as the deal, they've announced a new leadership team designed to kind of lead the business out of the Woolworths fold and into some sort of other deal. $2 billion is the number I've heard most recently for the Woolies fuel business.
Yeah, I heard $1.8 billion. It looked like it was much higher when...
funny that.
The BP.
Indeed.
Yeah. I mean, there's some logic here for Woolies. The loyalty of the customers, the rewards program basically brings people to these outlets. You can have some other convenience sales there and so on. But it's really not Woolies' core business, really. So,
It's a funny thing, you know, because as well as this deal, they also get to supply groceries to, I want to say, 700 Caltex stores around the country, I think. It's a really funny deal. Woolworths kind of feels like they're doing pretty well. Caltex feel like they're doing pretty well, despite the fact that Woolies kind of originally wanted to go with somebody else. And as you say, I think partly because they wanted to get rid of this business. It's a funny one. It's kind of a really important one for their, as you say, their loyalty program. They need a loyalty partner in fuel. I mean, they kind of started this story, right? And then Coles and Shell got together. Mm-hmm. At some level, kind of surprising. Well, I guess if you can keep the supply and keep the arrangement, you don't need to own the asset, right? It's one of those things. Right. It's a bit like regulation. You don't need to, government doesn't need to own a company to regulate it. Mm-hmm. And Woolies doesn't necessarily need to own the fuel stations to be able to redeem their petrol vouchers. But it does give me some reason for pause. Yes, you want to get rid of the asset. Is this just kind of financial engineering for its own sake? Are they trying to be too clever by half and then risking the kind of growth story? If I sold off, Woolworths Petrol decides not to accept Woolworths Shopper Dockets anymore. It kind of feels to me like they're kind of selling the crown jewels and hoping that they can keep a lease on them. Is that not too risky? Are they being too cute, or is there some legitimate value behind the sale?
Well, I think there's some legitimate value in the sense that, you know, if they can get an IPO happening here and they can unlock some value, that's this value unlock for Woolies shareholders. I mean, if I guess you're a Woolies shareholder, did you buy it for the Woolies grocery business, or did you buy it for the petrol business?
I'd take
the bet. And I mean, I understand their logic here. The way they started this is they wanted to provide Woolies customers with an easy access to petrol stations and you know, convenience, basically.
Yeah.
So expanding to these other 600 whatever stores, providing grocery facilities. I mean, it looks legitimate, but it's not the core business. And, you know, it's a bit of a financial engineering. It'll boost their, their coffers, and they can reduce some debt and things like that.
Right. I hear all that. The simple investor inside me, though, thinks it's a little bit. I hope it's not going to be something that woolly shareholders, you know, regret come 5 or 7 years' time when all of a sudden the supply deal goes away and the money's been spent and there's kind of a lot of whole value. Like, I get the value. It's a little bit like, I mean, we'll talk about Bellamy's later, but Bellamy's was supposed to be this capital light, wonderful branded business until the fact they didn't own the supply chain, almost literally sent them broke. And it just, I can't help but feeling like it's one of those things that is clever when times are good. But if times get tough, may well be, you know, a bit of penny wise, pound foolish. So yes, they made a bit of money selling the business, but I just worry they're not going to necessarily have much left over if the worst comes to pass and they lose that. All of a sudden, they've ceded the entire petrol discount market, if you like, to Coles. Woolies may or may not find another partner to do the deal with, or an inferior partner if they don't own the business anymore. I get why it's worth something to sell. It worries me that, yes, you're right, petrol isn't their core business, but kind of these fuel discounts have become such a core part of the kind of value proposition for supermarkets, that a supermarket without a discount program might be at a decent disadvantage to its competitors.
That is possible, and I don't discount that. But I think, you know, in the reality might be that they might be able to sell it off, the asset, and then do a deal with, let's say they sell it off to, I guess, Caltex, right? And then do a deal with Caltex saying, well, you know, honor our discount here, and you know, in return for that, they get customers, right? Customers come in. And maybe they actually can, you know, reap some value out of that. So it's possible.
Yeah. All right.
I don't have a strong feeling about it.
Yeah. So David Jones a few years ago did a deal with Amex. And the deal was that they did deal with the Amex card, the David Jones Amex card, co-branded. And Amex paid DJs all the money up front.
Mm-hmm.
And then in year 3 or 4, I think, the profit basically went away. So DJs had this front-loaded deal. I don't want to say management did it because it was front-loaded or necessarily did it in any underhanded or untoward way, but there was a sense that David Jones' profits were popped up by a few years of having this deal done, and it looked like a great deal to do until that profit went away and DJs couldn't fill the hole. And so there was a massive kind of profit hole when they finally got rid of it. It worries me when anyone undergoes an asset sale like this where it's still a strategic part of the company's opportunity or growth, yet they don't have control over it. Now, it kind of just sticks in my core a little bit.
I take that. You know, it's good to be cynical about these sort of things.
Skeptical
is the right word. I mean, I'm looking at a number. It says, like, you know, they're about, this Woolies petrol business is worth about $100 million in EBIT. That's not small. So
Right.
So, I mean, you know, there's a valid point there.
That being said, if you get $2 billion for it, I suppose that's 20 times earnings. You probably take that.
Yeah.
All right.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's move on from Woolies to another couple of consumer stocks, and I've already highlighted one of them. This week, I think it was Thursday this week, Doc, we saw a few brokers come out and downgrade two of the formerly darling stocks of the ASX, Bellamy's and Domino's.
Mm-hmm.
Both fell 9-point-something%, almost in some degree of sympathy on the day.
Mm.
The brokers are kind of abandoning these stocks. Now, I want to go through them one by one because some interesting kind of component parts to what we're talking about here. Let's do Bellamy's first. We'll do it in alphabetical order. Goldman Sachs downgraded Bellamy's price target, and we don't necessarily love price targets, but they downgraded the price target by 18% from, I want to say, $24 down to about $21, give or take. Don't do the maths because it's probably not exactly 18%, but trust me. And the shares fell 9% on the back of that, but to about $12. So here's Goldman Sachs on one hand saying, okay, well, look, we're not as optimistic as we used to be, yet our price target is still the best part of double the current share price. Why, in that scenario, do shareholders bail out rather than saying, well, great, there's still $9 worth of upside. We'll hold our shares till we get that, to achieve that result. Why bail out so significantly at a price below their target price? Yes, it's a downgrade, but surely it's a downgrade from awesome to simply wonderful rather than from kind of okay to terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Why is everyone abandoning ship?
Well, okay. First, I never understand price targets. It's amusing to see price targets.
Yeah.
Well, I think when there's a report out like that, I guess some people feel, well, you know, this might be the start of more bad news, right?
Yeah, okay.
It's coming just before earnings and, you know, earnings are going to start. Maybe some people feel, oh, these guys have some insider view. You know, people are skeptical and they might think, well, more bad news might follow.
Yeah.
Other people might downgrade. So why not, maybe get out now before, somebody downgrades it to like $10, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, these price targets are all over, 12-month period. That's really short term, right? And trying to figure out what the stock is going to do over the next 12 months is really hard. I mean, they did raise some concerns around Chinese approvals and things like that. I mean, if those things don't happen, then there are bigger problems, I guess, in the business.
Yeah, that's right. So the Chinese FDA, their version of our Therapeutic Goods Administration, and their version of the US FDA, which I'm sure is where they got the acronym from, they've delayed the approval of some of the Bellamy's products into China. And that's why Goldman Sachs have had a little bit of a concern. As you say, 12-month price targets, neither here nor there for long-term investors. But in the short term, Goldman Sachs are worried that maybe that approval won't come through as quickly as I'd otherwise hoped. I know it's not your thing, it's not my thing either, but what if you had to speculate, and you do because I'm asking you the question, you're on a podcast, so let's go with the idea.
Sure.
why for all of that, why are investors, it boggles my mind, the share type target is so much above the current share price. Why, as a shareholder, put yourself in those shareholders' minds, why were you selling on Thursday? What is it about Thursday's downgrade that made you think, well, gee, I would have taken a $24 share price, but not 21 when the price is already 12.
Mm.
It's like if someone said to me, look, I'll give you double the price for your house. I said, great. They said, oh, no, I won't anymore. I'll only give you 75% more. I don't know that I'm rushing to sell my house at a discount, right? I'm going to happily take the higher number.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's the perfectly rational thing to do, is to, not worry about the $3 change or $4 change in the price target, right? I think the issue here might be that sometimes, these broker houses, they have, things like conviction lists and so on. If they dropped it from the conviction list, somebody might say, well, I only want to have stocks that are in that conviction list.
Right,
I want high conviction stock.
Okay.
I don't want stuff that's trending downwards, right? I want things that are going up. I don't know. I mean, all sorts of logic could be applied. I mean, if you like the business and you thought the business is going to be doing well for like the next 5 years, I mean, why would you bother?
So if you held Bellamy's on Thursday morning, are you feeling less comfortable, more comfortable? Are you still positive about the company? I know you don't own it personally, but in the sense that, put yourself in those situations. Your Thursday morning, you see the broker note come out. They drop their price from 24 to 21. What are you thinking as an investor? Let's say it was a company you owned. Are you kind of thinking, well, I don't really care because I'm a long-term investor, or there's enough upside left, or are you a little bit worried, as you say, that maybe there's worse to come?
Well, I think in this case, the issues that they're raising are they're not $3 worth or the 18% of 12% or whatever they downgraded it by.
Right.
I mean, the problem is that for Bellamy's, China's a big market. And if for any reason the Chinese approval doesn't come through or has conditions and things like that, it's going to have a big impact on sales, right? It's also a very competitive market, right? There's A2 milk there. There are other products from Nestle and so on and so forth. So, I mean, if you don't get approval and your competitors do get approval, then you're going to lose market share to them.
So there's some sense that anything that stops them becoming one of the sort of first movers, it may well limit their overall value creation over the fullness of time?
Yeah, in the fullness of time, I mean, if you don't get approval, you don't have the market, right?
You don't
build a brand there in that market, and therefore you're disadvantaged.
Okay, so to some degree, there's some, regardless of what the price was on Wednesday night, there is some sense that the business is simply a slightly lower quality business come Thursday morning, because it increases the odds that maybe something might go wrong.
Yeah, maybe the risks have increased,
Risks
have increased, so you may be compensated for that. Some people maybe are not going to tolerate that risk and therefore decided to sell. That's my best speculation. I mean,
like it. Mate, keep speculating, because I'm going to turn to Domino's now. It also fell 9% on Thursday. And on the back of, I think, two or three broker downgrades along the day, it's tempting to look at that and kind of go, how come three brokers came out on the same day with a downgrade? It's tempting to see conspiracies everywhere in the market and to think that somehow someone knows something you don't. Then again, when two or three come out, you kind of start to think, maybe have they got some new information? Has something changed? What's going on in the background? Now, Domino's is one of the highest short interests on the ASX, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of those companies that really has been everything from a hated stock to a market darling, now back again to something, I don't know, somewhere in between, probably, I suppose. They went from $6 5 years ago to up to $77, I think, 18 months ago.
How much is it now? About 35?
Yeah, about 35, 40 bucks recently. So, it depends on when you bought it. You've either still got a six-bagger, or you've lost half your money, or maybe both if you hold it the whole way through. Talk to me about Domino's, mate. Your thoughts on where the business is, three brokers downgrading at the same time, just so close to earnings season. one, two, okay, three starts to feel like maybe something's going on or someone knows something.
So, I mean, okay, I'm going to speculate. I don't actually follow Domino's that closely. I have some thoughts, though, about Domino's. So, one is, Tumit looks like they're a pretty, you know, they're a pretty mature business in Australia.
Yeah.
Right. And now, I'll add something. Whenever I've gone to a Domino's, the line just amazes me. So they must be doing
so true. So
they must be doing something right. I mean, they have really tiny shops that have this. You know, so they must not be paying a lot of money for those shops. And I understand that they're all franchised. But I mean, even the franchisee doesn't have to pay a lot. And they have these, you know, this humongous line, and you know, you wait to get your pizza. Your pizza is coming in 60 minutes. I mean, that's a lot of demand. So I guess Australians, you know, we all love having a lot of pizza.
We do.
So that's good. But it looks to me there's a Domino's in every corner.
Yep.
Right.
I think that's probably right.
So growth seems hard. Yeah, that's my guess.
Right.
They have European operations, which they're trying to grow. I believe they're in Japan, which they're trying to grow.
Yep. Correct.
So growth is mostly international driven, is my take. With these broker downgrades, sometimes these brokers, you know, they do, channel checks equivalent, which might be, you know, trying to figure out whether there has been same store sales equivalent, which is essentially looking at this year, last year, comparing the store base that you had and trying to figure out whether there was growth there. They might have done something like that and figure that growth is maybe not as good as, you know, what they had hoped, and therefore they downgraded. I don't know. I think some of the growth issues might be legitimate. I mean, I have to say, the issues were definitely more significant when they were like in a $70 stock, and you know, less significant when it's a $35 stock. So, you know, those are the guesses. Maybe they know something, you know, based on channel checks that other people don't know.
It's fun. And I guess the other thing too is that short term nature, right? Of, you know, is it going to have a tough 6 month period that the reporting period that Broadie is about to unveil, or is there something else down the pike?
Yeah.
I've got something of a confession to make that my members of Motley Fool Share Advisor will know only too well, which is we recommended Domino's at $6 and sold at $13, and I felt like a genius because I'd made money for our members and it was great. And then the shares, as I've already mentioned, went up about sixfold from there and still are up about threefold from the price I sold. So I've got to rub my nose in a mistake as I do this. But it's also worth saying at the time, way back then, we saw same store sales, the growth rate start to decline a little bit. I'm talking about maybe 2014, 2013 maybe.
Yeah.
And you know, so I thought, well, growth rate's starting to slow. Maybe there's no more opportunity left. And 5 years later, it's possible, just possible, that maybe we're thinking the same thing, that the long-term story might yet have a bit more to go. I'm reminded a little bit of Starbucks, although I wouldn't necessarily say they're the same quality business, of kind of that sense of kind of, you know, too many stores, not enough stores, trying to find the right number of stores in the right locations that really managed to allow them to grow both total number of stores, but also sales per store. I'm bullish on Domino's, I have to say, at the current price. I don't know what's going to happen this 6 month period. Maybe it's a terrible result. Maybe it's a great result. Maybe it's probably somewhere in between. The long term future, though, I think to your point, so many lines out the door. So many people eating Domino's. Domino's are trying to get into other things like chicken wings and desserts. Exactly. Their ability to increase all of those things. So number of stores, the number of people who use each store, the average basket size that we talk about in retail, where they're buying not just a pizza, but a drink, some garlic bread, some chicken wings, and maybe a, you know,
dessert.
Yeah, exactly, a mud cake or something. You know, it's there's different ways of doing it, but there is absolutely, as you say, a natural, you know, kind of high watermark. And to some degree, they've pretty much got rid of Eagle Boys. Pizza Hut, sorry, is pretty much a shadow of its former self. When we were kids, we used to go to Pizza Hut in the restaurants and eat there all you can eat at the salad bar. And Pizza Hut was the thing, right? Domino's was up and coming.
That's just gone, right?
Right. So 10 years later, 15 years later.
No salad bars.
Maybe 20 years later, I'm getting a bit older. You know, it doesn't take much, right? And so I think there's something to that as well.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's talk about some of what's going on in the media and advertising industry. Now, if we went back 3 or 4 years and we talked about advertising in the media, the broad concept was this. Free-to-air TV is going to get killed by subscription television, pay TV. Mm-hmm. Pay TV is going to get killed by online advertising. The only future for advertising is online because you can do it's pay-per-click. No one's advertising on TV. No one's watching TV. No one's advertising on traditional media, newspapers, billboards. It's all gone. It's all about online. Now, fast forward 4 or 5 years, and the hottest sector in advertising right now is the outdoor advertising market. The old-fashioned billboards, literally almost the very first, you know, pre-TV, maybe even pre-radio, there were billboards. Right? This is probably the oldest mass media advertising market around. And it's having something of a massive, massive comeback. What's going on in that market, and what's it kind of spawning around the corporate activity?
So I'll take a slightly different take. I wouldn't say that they're...
You know, ignore my question altogether, right?
Yeah. I'm not
do your best.
I'll try my best. So I wouldn't say that they are making a massive comeback. I think that it's an industry that's going a massive change.
Okay.
I'd say that.
Okay.
And I think... I mean, they're still under attack from the other forces that you mentioned. But what is interesting there is they are, essentially, taking on technology and trying to do things there in different ways.
Right.
So the traditional billboard used to be, one billboard sign that somebody would climb and change every,
We've all seen them, with the big broom pasting up the individual slices of paper. Yep.
A massive effort. So, but now the terminology here is called furnitures, right? These are called furnitures.
Right.
You have the street furnitures where you have the...
The bus shelters, that kind of stuff.
Bus shelters. And these big billboards around the city or on the highways and things like that.
And these are the digital billboards, right? So it's all big TV screens now, not blokes with brooms and pots of glue.
Exactly. Well, that's the big change, right? So, and now they think that they can use the fact that it's digital, and then they could therefore digitally beam things there on the fly. They can actually use technology to figure out, based on the type of people that are driving, during the morning hours, you may show different things. In the evening hours, you might show different things. You can cycle through multiple ads instead of having one ad stuck there for like 30 days. So that's sort of the change that's happening. And I think that the other change is happening is in terms of scale. People are trying to build scale to compete with the online guys, right? So that's why we are seeing a lot of takeovers and mergers and so on.
Right. So that's what I want to get to, right? So and these guys are on high PEs, right? So the O-Medias and the APN Outdoors and the Here, There and Everywheres of the world, these guys are on really junky PEs, partly because the growth has been really, really great over the last 5 years. So your point, yes, maybe they're not coming back necessarily, but as you say, the ability to, you can make so much more money out of a digital billboard just because it's digital in the first place. So rather than one ad, one picture, one message, you can have a moving message, a revolving message. You can have stuff scrolling and pictures, and it's more vibrant. And then you can, as you say, charge people different rates for different times of the day, or you can have multiple advertisers on the same billboard. So each bit of real estate is delivering much, much more revenue for its owner and the agent, in this case, the big advertising companies. Yet there's a whole lot of takeovers going on. So we've seen JC Deco out of France. People will see the JC Deco name around, maybe on the back of taxis or bus stops. It's now coming to take over APN Outdoor. We've seen O-Media, O-Media, trying to buy a piece of Here, There and Everywhere, the ad shell business, the street furniture you talked about. What's driving the consolidation? Is M&A fever taking over, or is there genuine value here in the consolidation?
Well, so I think what happens is, my favorite terminology is this, a business is dead, which is not really dead.
You do like to say things are dead a lot, I've noticed.
So when I say
Shades of the Dead Parrot sketch, but in reverse, I think.
So when I say it's dead, what I basically mean is, it's going to slowly saunter around.
You're a growth investment. Anything not growing at 45% is dead, let's be honest.
It's each going to grow at like 5% forever, which is not a bad business. I mean, I'll take it.
At the right price.
At the right price. So in this case, that's what is happening. I mean, in this particular case, I think O-Media offered to buy the
ad shell.
Ad shell.
Yep.
But they got outbid by, APN Outdoor actually.
That's right.
Put in a bid, and they got
outbid by O-Media, correct?
Yeah, they got outbid.
And the French came and bought APN Outdoor to really add misery, add insult to injury. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I think they're just trying to build scale here,
right?
And if you have a significant scale, I guess it gives you some buying power, and some pricing power in terms of the ads that you want to show. And I think that's sort of what's going on is really it's an industry, and we see that happening in the media landscape as well, right? I mean, we're seeing Disney trying to buy someone else.
Right.
And again, that's because it's an industry under attack.
And Disney and Comcast are bidding for the Fox assets, or most of the Fox assets.
So it's a sort of the same phenomenon, I think.
So how do you think about, talking about media and advertising, we know it's horribly cyclical. And in Australia, at least, we've been through 26 years of unbroken growth. So it's hard not to make money in advertising in Australia, at least for the past couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably leads a lot of people to forget that these things are cyclical.
Yes.
When the economy turns down, all of a sudden, we're going to see a whole lot of companies pull their marketing dollars. If you pull your marketing dollars, then you can't charge as much for that marketing space, whether that's a billboard or 30 seconds on TV or a cost per click ad on online somewhere on your favorite website. How do you think about the advertising and media industries, generally speaking?
Yeah, so I think you're right. So it's a cyclical. Economic activity is going to decide what's going to, you know, how much people are willing to pay for these ads. So I guess, you know, bulking up basically helps, right? I mean, in the bad times, you might be actually able to survive. If you're a small player, actually be squeezed out completely. On the other hand, if you're a big player, maybe the best time to buy a smaller asset is when they're being squeezed out at a good price, right? So I don't know. I personally feel that the media industry right now is undergoing consolidation because it thinks it needs to do that, and it's paying high prices. It looks to me like Disney is paying a lot for Fox. It looks like these guys are here paying like what, $1 billion or something was the deal here.
Not bad, is it? It's good to be a seller. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, so it looks to be a good market for the seller, bad market for the buyer.
Right.
Which means that what's left over after these aggregations is probably not good. So that's what I feel about it. I've largely stayed away from this industry, the billboards industry. So.
Me too, I have to say. I've been tempted a few times. They've got, like, the last 5 years, the growth has been really, really strong. But I have to say, again, cyclical industry, as you say, consolidation coming. And to some degree, they've kind of made, particularly the outdoor advertising guys, they've made all the hay they're going to make. They've kind of gone through that transformation now. Almost all billboards, or all significant size billboards in good places, are digital.
Yeah.
They've already kind of charging as much as they can for the advertisers. You kind of get that step change once, right? There's a whole lot of industries. The move to cloud computing, for example, cloud accounting is one such thing. Once you get to the end game of that, in any particular industry, then you're back to kind of regular GDP-ish type growth. And I think, to my mind, that's the problem with advertising. Not only is it cyclical, but you've also got that kind of, you know, high-low, you know, you get high growth until you saturate the market.
Exactly.
And then you're back to growing at GDP. I think they've done exceptionally well. These guys deserve all the plaudits they get for reinventing an industry.
Yep.
They've done it really, really well. But again, sometimes extrapolation can kill you. And I think in this case, it may well be the case.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I hesitate to bring this next one up because I know you like to rant about property. And this isn't even the rant. This is the pre-rant rant.
Right.
We saw Macquarie come out this week.
Yes.
And so here's the thing. Up until that point, the general view has been APRA, so the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, who control the banks, have been cracking down on the amount of money that banks can lend. Banks themselves have been taking fewer risks. So goes the theory. So goes the kind of general consensus. Mm-hmm. Macquarie did what they call mystery shopping. So they sent some undercover kind of potential mortgage borrowers out into the market and went and just tried to test the waters. Their conclusion, somewhat against the current orthodoxy, is there is no significant reduction in the amount of credit out there. So much for a credit crunch that was supposed to be coming out to restrict what borrowers could borrow, force house prices down, all that kind of good stuff. Macquarie are pretty much saying it's business as usual.
Mm. So what's interesting about it is that Macquarie came out of that report and basically UBS came out of the report, I think, which is on the AFR today, which basically kind of contradicts that.
Something for everyone.
Something for everyone. So I think my view is this. I think there is no credit crunch happening yet, right? I mean, if you are, I think what has changed is if you are a borrower who can borrow, you can still borrow.
Right.
But I think the borrowing conditions or the credit conditions have become more strict. I think the banks are asking for more deposit, and they're probably looking at your ability to pay more or pay the loan that you're taking more carefully, right? Is that a credit crunch? Not really. I think what UBS is making a different point. What UBS is trying to say is that most of the contraction that had to happen in the investor land or in the investors, the property investors' land has happened.
Right.
And if the Royal Commission is ongoing and if there are more strict, lending criteria that come through that, then those will, you know, cause further changes,
right?
And this is for the owner lender or owner borrower category. Now they claim that, you know, the borrowing capacity could shrink by 30%, right?
Wow, okay. Right?
Now, and they're pointing to a couple of other things, and this is something we've talked about before. So they're saying that, look, you know, the bank swap rate, which is essentially the bank bill swap rate, which is the rate at which banks lend to each other.
Yes.
That has been going up, mm-hmm. Largely because the cost for borrowing for the banks have gone up.
Right.
Right. And therefore, if that pressure remains, eventually the banks are going to pass on those to the borrowers.
I don't think there's anything more sure. Nothing is certainly other than death and taxes.
Yeah.
But rising interest rates from banks themselves, not necessarily RBA, but from banks themselves over the next, 6 to 12 months?
Yeah.
It's hard to believe we won't see every one of the major banks increase rates at least once, and maybe not even by a large amount, but by some amount between now and this time next year.
10 basis points or 0.110 or 0.08 or something like that, you know, is very likely, because they're going to try to protect their margins, right?
Well, we'll have no choice, right? You either have to pass on to borrowers, you have to tell shareholders not going to get their dividend.
Exactly.
And no bank CEO is gutsy enough to tell their shareholders not going to get a dividend.
Exactly. And I mean, so UBS, I mean, I think Macquarie was making the point. I think Macquarie's point of that article was that, you know, the bank shares are cheap, relatively speaking, historically speaking, and things like that. But, you know, the headwinds are still there for the bank shares, right? In terms of rising interest rates, which might have pressures on their interest margins, net interest margins, and so on. So
I haven't changed your mind. Banks aren't a great deal yet.
Oh, banks are not a great deal. Property investing is not a great deal. Well, I'll change my mind. I mean, but it looks like we are. What I honestly believe is that we have been in a low interest rate environment for so long that people just can't believe that interest rates can go up.
Yep.
And then in Australia is such a lucky country. It has no recession for 27 years, 26 years.
Right.
So people believe there can never be a recession. and
what could possibly go wrong?
And I said, never say never.
Yeah, right.
Right. So that's my mind.
I will say, for the record, lest I leave our listeners in any misunderstanding, I'm also not a big fan of bank stocks at the moment. I'm not as bearish as you are, Doc, but I do think that the headwinds they're sailing into mean that market beating performance from the banks is incredibly unlikely over the next 5 or 10 years. I think maybe at the end of that period, you might get a few decent years, but the reality of rising house price, possibly stagnating or falling house prices, the almost certainty of rising interest rates. Frankly, they already own the market. There's not a lot of market share growth for any of them either. Hard to kind of put together the combination of factors that gives a market beating share price performance over the next 5 or 10 years, I think.
Yeah. Captain, I'll just add, you know, you said I'm bearish. I'm not saying that bank shares are go to zero.
No. That's proper dead.
Yeah.
Bearish as in like they're not going to beat the market.
They're not going to beat the market. I mean, you're agreeing with me.
Correct.
What I think.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, I don't think they're going to beat the market. Yep. I mean, you know, they can match the market because they're most of the market.
Yep.
So,
yep.
And I think they will give you the dividends.
There's a really good point. I'll hold this over. Okay. I'll rant about this later. Mm. But suffice it to say, if you listen next week, you might hear me talk about how to beat the market without being the market. There's a bit of a tease for you.
Okay.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate. Mm. Disappointingly, we haven't got Liam with us, unfortunately. And a shout out to Liam. His family's a bit crook, and so he's off to the doctor this morning as we record this on Friday. So we won't have the race caller calling the horses into the stall, but despite that, I will give you the opportunity to saddle up on the Motley Fool Money high horse. Let it rip, mate.
All right. Okay. So one of my pet peeves, really my pet peeves, is...
There we go. You're getting the spirit of it. I like this.
This is
come on. Let me have it.
This is not property, actually.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, so talk to anyone about the share market, and I'm talking to general public and friends and so on. The stock market is very risky.
Well, it is.
It's super risky.
Get Swift's crashed.
I don't want to lose it.
Beginner's crashed.
Right.
Blue Sky has crashed. Unlocked didn't even make it to the market. Who the hell wants to buy shares?
Exactly. Who the one?
Too risky, mate. Too risky.
Too risky.
Too risky.
But I think what people here forget is that risk and volatility are two different things.
Right. No, if it goes up, I make money. If I go down, I lose money. So if it's volatile, I lose money. No,
it goes up a little bit, goes down a little bit. But over time, it actually goes up. What people forget is the stock markets have delivered fantastic returns. So I looked at a report recently which looked at 100 years of the market.
Right.
And we were number two. The Australian stock market has the second highest return, inflation adjusted, in the past 100 years.
But it's a casino, mate. It's an absolute casino. You've seen the share price all over the place. They're up one day, down the next. The smart money's in there making money from us poor mugs. How the hell is share investing not risky?
So when they say the market, they basically mean that you could just buy some index fund and you could have actually got 8%, 9% return over a 100-year period. Now, if you compound that, that's a lot of money. Now, you can take
a shed load, I think it's the official term.
I don't know, bucket load, whatever, you know, ocean load, whatever you want to call it. You could put your money in a term deposit and get 2%.
Yeah.
Right? You're not going to keep up with inflation. You can put it anywhere else, maybe you get a little bit more. The stock market is risky on an individual stock basis, but if you have a diversified portfolio of enough number of stocks taking, you know, a balanced risk-reward sort of outlook, you can do really well in the stock
market. Right, so all you're going to do is buy a diversified portfolio and it'll never fall.
Oh, it will fall.
Well, that's risky then. Hang on, wait, you can't say both. What is it? Is it risky or is it not?
It's not risky if it falls, because if it falls, you just buy more.
what if I'm in retirement though? I can't afford to buy anymore.
Right.
So then I'm stuffed. I lose money.
Well, okay. So if you're, say, retiree, and your portfolio is delivering you 5% of in terms of income via dividends.
It's pretty good. A few franking credits on top of that.
Check some franking credits. That's you know, grossed up, it will be 6.5, something like that. What's your problem even if your principal falls a bit? It falls and then it goes back
up. But what if it doesn't come back up? That's what I'm worried about, Doc. I'm 68, I've retired. Mm. I see my portfolio fall 40% during the GFC and I'm just ready to tear my hair out.
Mm. So what happened after the GFC? The markets have had a fantastic run after GFC. So those people who sold in GFC.
Right.
Have lost out on an opportunity to have fantastic returns over the last 10 years. Right. Fair enough. Happens every time. You know, you can sell out and then you can just wait. You can wait till the market hits its new high and then buy in. In the interim, you would lose out on the returns.
So I'm going to try and summarize what you just said, Matt, because I completely agree for what it's worth. I do like playing devil's advocate just for fun. But a couple of things. So first, I think you and I would both agree, if there's any money you need from your capital, you shouldn't have it in the share market, your expenses over the next 3 to 5 years, right? If you need to live off that capital, you don't want to be forced to sell when the market falls, and it will fall again. You don't want to be forced to sell. You want to have that money set aside, either the income from the dividends, if you've got enough of a nest egg to live off the dividends, or if you're going to have to use some of that capital, put the first 3 to 5 years worth of expenses aside, have that in cash or something, term deposit. Yes, you won't get a great return, but at least you won't be forced to sell at a loss. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. Second thing is, yes, markets fall, but over time, and this is one of my favorites, they've gained 10% a year despite those falls, not in the absence of them. So yes, despite the GFC, despite the 87 crash, despite the dot-com crash, despite the Great Depression, all of those things over the last century have happened, and yet the market has still returned 10%. So time is your friend, not your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
How's that?
I absolutely agree with that.
Good man. Well, that does wrap us up, Doc. But before we go, don't forget, listener, you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please do give us a big 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your friends. It'll help other people find the podcast. And we like that, and hopefully so will you. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can send us a message on Twitter. We're at TheMotleyFoolAU, or send us an email at info@fool.com.au, and we will cover your questions, comments, and feedback in an upcoming mailbag episode. In fact, stay tuned, because that's what we're doing next week. Well, that's it for us for this week in Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Thanks for listening, and fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.